Hello, this is ESVS Podcast. My name is Vaiva Dabravolskaite, and I am sending my regards to you from the ESVS annual meeting in Krakow, where we are recording live. Today we will talk about pelvic venous disease, focusing on different embolization strategies. I'm excited to introduce today's speaker, Professor Athimios Avgerinos, a professor of surgery at the University of Pittsburgh, USA, a visiting professor of vascular surgery at the University of Athens, Greece, and a co-director at the vascular and endovascular clinic at Athens Medical Center. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Vaiva. It's a great pleasure to join the ESVS podcast, and I'm looking forward to a fruitful discussion.
Likewise. We have quite a topic to fit in a limited time today, so let's start. Before that, I would like to shortly refresh our memories on pelvic venous disease, also known as pelvic congestion syndrome. It is a condition characterized by chronic pelvic pain caused by the dilation of veins in the pelvic area. Like varicose veins in the legs, pelvic veins can become enlarged or incompetent, meaning the valves inside the veins fail to function properly, which leads to poor blood flow and vein enlargement. PVD primarily affects women, especially those who have had multiple pregnancies, but men can also experience pelvic venous problems, albeit less frequently. It is often related to the following, so hormonal changes, pregnancy, genetic factors. Key features of pelvic venous disease are chronic pelvic pain, as mentioned before, varicose veins, pain after prolonged activity, and other symptoms may be pain during or after sexual intercourse, menstrual irregularities or heavy periods, urinary problems such as urgency or frequency changes, and for men, varicose cells, scrotal heaviness, and groin testicular pain. Pelvic pain of venous origin in women was an article published by Endovascular Today in 2024, so a very fresh one. It focuses on venous origin chronic pelvic pain, a condition often misdiagnosed or overlooked in women. Symptoms are commonly dull, bilateral pain with occasional sharp flares, worsening with activities like standing or walking, and improving when lying down. To sum up, it may be confusing to get the final diagnosis, and in my limited experience, not only with the chronic pelvic pain. Professor, could you briefly introduce diagnostic methods of the PVD in general, which may help us to avoid this delayed diagnosis?
Well, as you very well described, there is a constellation of symptoms that are difficult to identify and point out that this may be pelvic congestion, or to be more accurate, pelvic venous disease. So the female patients eventually get lost in the medical system till somebody thinks of pelvic venous disease and refers these patients to the appropriate vascular interventionalists. So we have a lot of work to do in raising awareness for the disease. Diagnosis starts with discussing with the patient. You need to listen to the patient. You need to identify the symptoms. You need to ask the appropriate questions. Where do you have the pain? When do you have the pain? How deep is the pain? What exacerbates the pain? Do you have pain during sexual intercourse? Do you have menstrual pain and things like that? And is the pain on the back? Is the pain on the front? Is the pain going down the leg? And so on. Good physical exam should always follow this discussion. And then we come to imaging. And imaging is not easy. It all starts with a duplex scan, an appropriate duplex scan by a skilled operator. I cannot do this type of ultrasound scan. I always have to ask a dedicated practitioner for pelvic venous ultrasound. There is also the transvaginal ultrasound. Again, this is a little sensitive to do. I personally don't do it, but skilled practitioners can identify the areas of pelvic escape at the perineum and acknowledge that there is a pelvic venous disease. Now, following the duplex, when I have eventually a high index of suspicion that there is pelvic venous disease, I'm going to ask for axial imaging. And it really depends on the institution, whether you're going to ask for a CT venogram or an MR venogram. In my institution, we feel more familiar with CT venograms and we get appropriate images. You can look at the left renal vein, you can look at the ovarian vein, you can look at the pelvic veins and so on. But eventually, the final diagnosis will come with venography, traditional venography plus minus intravascular ultrasound when you want to assess whether there's renal vein stenosis or if there's a common iliac vein compression and so on. And a full venographic study should always include the left renal vein, the left ovarian vein, the right ovarian vein, both common iliac veins, both internal iliac veins. This is a full study to come with the final diagnosis and sources of pelvic venous disease.
I think you pointed out a really important finding that actually those patients are usually young as well. And you always have a discussion with them. Those are smart people. You can always have a really good anamnesis from them because they will point out and they will tell you things which may help us avoid this delayed diagnosis because they will lead you to what you have to do, at least in a big part.
Exactly.
Which is probably a little bit of difference with other vascular diseases where you might not necessarily get so much from anamnesis because of the age.
It is surprising that these patients will stay for years with their gynecologist discussing what may be the source of pain. They may be looking for endometriosis, and it's not endometriosis, it's pelvic venous disease. And many gynecologists do not even know about pelvic venous disease. Yeah. So we are working on raising awareness, and this is what we're doing today, actually.
Exactly. And maybe you could share what classification you use for pelvic congestion syndrome.
Well, we're fortunate enough to have a very comprehensive classification system right now. It got published in 2021, and it was led by the American Society of Venous and Lymphatics, and it was led actually by Mark Meissner. It's the SVP classification, and you know, this was done to eliminate the haziness that we had in pelvic venous disease. And we had nomenclature like Nutcracker syndrome or May-Thurner or pelvic congestion. We don't really want to keep on using these terms. We'd rather use pelvic venous disease and particularly the SVP classification. These are three domains: symptoms, varices, physiology. And the physiology then has subcategories: anatomic, hemodynamic, and etiologic. It's quite complicated to go thoroughly through it, but just to give you an example, when we say S for symptoms, it would be S0 when you have no symptoms, S1 when you have renal symptoms of venous origin, S2 when you have pelvic symptoms, and S3 when you have extrapelvic symptoms, and so on.
Yeah, we will share the classification in our show notes so that the listeners can take a look at it. And now let's try to move to possible treatment strategies. So let's start with the basics. So lifestyle changes, avoid long periods of standing or sitting, wearing compression stockings and elevating the legs may help with the symptoms relief. Medication, anti-inflammatory drugs can help relieve pain. Endovascular procedures, so then we will go more thoroughly to vein embolization, so sclerotherapy can reduce the symptoms and because they block blood flow to affected veins, and then the surgical options. Let's wrap this in a bit more detail.
Okay, so again, I need to stress that we treat patients' symptoms, we don't treat images. You know, many times if we do like randomly an ultrasound of the pelvis, we may see ovarian vein dilatation. We may see left common iliac vein compression. Half of the patient out there in the population may have some kind of left common iliac vein compression. This doesn't mean that they have pelvic venous disease. Or many patients who have a low BMI will actually have left renal vein compression. This doesn't mean they have pelvic venous disease. So we don't treat images, we treat patients' symptoms. So for the symptomatic patient that I have confirmed that there is a primary ovarian vein reflux, because this is the most frequent case scenario, I'm going to perform ovarian vein embolization. I'm going to try for 6 months conservative management before jumping into the procedure. But would you like me to go through the technical aspects of the procedure?
Yeah, but before that, I was thinking maybe you can give a comment on patient's age and wishfulness, because we are usually talking about reproductive age females. So before we go to the technical part of it, how do you approach that? Is it a contraindication to perform a procedure in general?
It's definitely not. So the patients are typically young ladies between 20s and 30s, but many times we'll also see ladies between their 20s and 30s after having several children. But sometimes they may not even have any kids. yet they have pelvic congestion symptoms. And it's not a contraindication to treat. Actually, there are some studies indicating that infertility can be treated by ovarian vein embolization. I don't think we have too much data to support that, but this is anecdotally out there. Now, if you place a stent in a left common iliac vein, if you have a compression, again, we have enough data indicating that if subsequently the female patient gets pregnant, it's unlikely that the stent will fracture or thrombose, and we have enough data to claim that now.
Thank you so much, because I think there is a lot of misconception around the reproductive age and the treatment of the condition. So maybe now we can cover the technical aspects of the embolization itself.
So let me focus a little bit on the ovarian vein embolization, because this is like the most frequently done procedure. And there is not a single way to do it right, starting from access, going into the way you cannulate the ovarian vein, or the type of embolic materials you use. So I personally like going through the femoral vein, but many people like going through the basilic vein. So going through the femoral vein, I will typically have a 5 or 6 French sheath. I will use a glide catheter and glide wire, hydrophilic glide wire. I will cannulate the left renal vein using a Cobra catheter, and then get my wire down into the left ovarian vein, get my catheter down, and then over a stiff, like Rosen wire, I get a 6 French sheath inside the left ovarian vein, and then get my 5 French catheter, and through the 5 French catheter, get a micro catheter to get it down deep into the pelvis. Well, I would start embolizing.
So basically, we're talking about very selective embolization.
Yes, it's that we use the telescope technique for very selective embolization. And then we come to the embolic materials that we can use. Again, we have a variety of embolic materials we can use. I like what we call the sandwich technique. That's a combination of sclerosant agents and coils. So we like the sclerosant material down at the pelvic floor, because it will fill in the reservoir down in the pelvis, there where no coil can reach. So I will start with injecting foam, typically polidocanol, 2 or 3%, 1-to-4 ratio, and then I will start injecting coils. Now, the coils can be either pushable or detachable. There are advantages in both sides. If you use pushable coils, they are much cheaper. There is a small risk of migration, but if you use long and big coils, it's unlikely they will migrate. The detachable coils are safer because you can control where exactly they are placed, but they are much more expensive. Now, as far as the length of the ovarian vein that you're going to fill in with the coils, again, there are different strategies. Some people, and I am one of them, will fill the entire ovarian vein all the way up to the origin at the left renal vein. Some people will just intermittently place coils in 2 or 3 spots and then stop, risking that some collaterals may remain open. So I'd rather fill in the majority of the length of the ovarian vein to avoid letting the collaterals patent.
Which probably
may
would lead to
recurrence.
Exactly, and more procedures for the patient.
Yes. And this is the most frequent scenario that I described, but there are also scenarios that you have to also go and embolize the right ovarian vein. Cannulation of the right ovarian vein can be a little more challenging. People find it easier to do from the jugular or the basilic vein axis coming from top down. But you can use a seam catheter coming from the femoral vein. It comes off the vena cava, and it will get you down again in a similar way that we did for the left ovarian vein. It will get you down to the pelvic floor, and then you can again start the sandwich technique and so on.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm thinking what is more convenient for the patient as well in logistics of your angio suite and stuff, what is easier. And what are you used to probably at the end of the day is, how do they say, don't try something you have never done before if it's a complex procedure.
Yes, for sure. Maybe I should also add, just for the people who are listening to us, it's not only coils and foam. Some people would rather use glue. Some people would rather use Onyx. So it's really what you are familiar with using.
And what is available probably
exactly,
as well in the market.
Exactly.
So just to sum up, embolization may be performed by coils. We can have sclerotherapy. We can have foam sclerosant. We can have glue or gel foam. So, and this variety of possible tools is really depending on what you're used to, what you are trained to do, and what is available, because all of those things, I mean, not everybody has all of those things in the shelf as well.
Exactly.
In the study by Maria Jo et al. About ovarian vein embolization, how and when should it be done, autists reported about from 50 to 80% of significant symptom relief after the procedure with reductions in pain, dyspareunia, dysmenorrhea, with a low rate of complication. They described cold migration and post-procedural pain as the main challenges, which eventually with time disappeared as well. Another study by Marlene about diagnosis and treatment of pelvic congestion syndrome reported more variation in symptom relief in the literature. Is your clinical experience compatible with the ones reported, and may you share upon pitfalls you have encountered during the process or after the procedure itself?
So actually, I feel these numbers are very accurate. There is always like a 20% of the patients who will find no relief. In my experience, or let's say my guesstimate, is that 50% of the patients will find complete relief, 20 to 30% of the patients will have partial relief, and 20% of the patients will have no relief. And amongst those who find a complete relief or partial relief, 20% of them will have some kind of recurrence within a year. And most times the recurrence may come from other sources of reflux. And then you go back and you find an internal iliac vein refluxing right or left. And this is when you have, again, to embolize. By the way, and I didn't report on that before, embolizing the internal iliac vein can be challenging and carries a high risk of migration if you use coils. So when it comes to internal iliac vein embolization, I use practically sclerosants. I inflate a Fogarty balloon, 5 French, and then inject foam, polydocanol, 3%, wait for 5 minutes. Till this fills
in
the reservoir.
So that it would be selective and it would not migrate to somewhere we don't want it to end up.
Yes.
And is that, maybe it's a lack of my experience, but the migration, is it more common in veins because of the type of the vessel we are talking about, because of its ability to...
To distend?
Yeah.
Exactly. It's this type of the vessel. It's the path that also, it's the pathophysiology, but it's also the path that the coil might follow to migrate. If you have a straight vein that ends up into the common iliac vein, you know where this is going to end. And it's the flow pattern, and it's the internal iliac veins also do not have valves. So all these factors coming in may lead to coil migration.
And does the choice of different embolization materials affect the incidence and characteristics of the complications?
As discussed, only coils can lead to migration. If you choose a very small coil, if you choose a very short coil, and you put it in a bigger vessel, this may migrate.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who are inexperienced, I would recommend they'd rather use detachable coils so they have better control of the deployment of the coil and make sure that it stays where it's deployed.
And how often and what are the indications for bilateral embolization compared to unilateral procedure? And how should bilateral embolization be staged? I know you already touched up a little bit on that one, that we start with the left one and then we sometimes go for the right one. But maybe you can elaborate on this a bit more.
So the strategies are really all over the map. If I have a profoundly dilated refluxing left ovarian vein and the right ovarian vein is so-and-so, I would just do the left ovarian vein first. Don't forget that if you have a refluxing left ovarian vein that is severely dilated, you may get compensatory dilatation of the contralateral ovarian vein. So in these cases, I may opt to wait. Now, if I have a profoundly right ovarian vein at the same time with the left ovarian vein, dilated both, refluxing both, I may just go and coil embolize both. But in principle, I'd rather stage it, despite knowing that some people will coil embolize both ovarian veins and will embolize with foam both internal iliac veins. This may be an overstretch, but I understand at the same time, if you don't do it, it has higher recurrence rates.
Yeah. But probably we should again remind ourselves that it's patient to patient, like case to case, based off of a performance of procedure and diagnostic. And it's not,
and
everything does not fit all.
Yes. And we need to discuss with the patient so that she has the appropriate expectations. It's not appropriate to tell her we do it once and you're done forever. No, we do it once. We may have to do it again. We may have to do it again. And at the end, there is a good chance that you will find a relief.
And so we naturally kind of reached the following question. What can you comment on the recurrence or reintervention actually rate? It's not the same as recurrence. Reintervention in your clinic and in the literature maybe?
I would say it's rough. The recurrence rate is 20% at 1 year, and the recurrence and the reintervention rate, I would say it's 20 to 30%. Now, why symptoms come back? They come back because, again, there is a missed source of or a new source of reflux, so you have to go back and embolize again. Sometimes symptoms never go away because you had the wrong diagnosis. And as discussed, there are many other pathologies that are in the area, and it may not be pelvic venous disease. That's why you have to have a thorough discussion with the patient and create appropriate expectations.
I would like to summarize. I think it's a good way to remember the numbers. So we had 20% of patients who do not usually have any relief of symptom. We have 20% of reintervention and recurrence rate. So it's easy to
right.
remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's lock this 20. And there is an ongoing research embolized trial. I've read about it, and it aims to gather more data on the efficacy and improve diagnosis and treatment standards. Could you tell us a little bit more about the trial and the way it's designed?
Yes, we are fortunate to have this randomized trial coming in. That's the EMBOLIZE trial that I think is supported by the Society for Interventional Radiology. Since the strategies for management are all over the map, now this trial introduces ovarian vein embolization. Patients will be randomized to embolization against no embolization. The patients will be followed up for 6 months. The control arm, if at 6 months there is no improvement, they will have the option to eventually get the embolization. But running this blinded, randomized trial, we will have the answer whether embolization actually helps. We will have the answer what are the complications, what is the actual recurrence rate, what is the actual reintervention rate. And we will have a more standardized treatment plan.
When should we expect primary results?
I would say at least 3 years from now.
And I think this trial is supported by multiple organizations, and I think it's one of the strengths of it. So as you mentioned, the Society of Interventional Radiology is involved, then the Viva Foundation, then there is a lot of vascular specialists, gynecologists, intervention radiologists. Could you tell us which disciplines should be involved in this patient treatment? So you talked about gynecologists, that usually people start from there.
Yes, yes. And this is a very good question. This is not a one-man show or one-woman show. This requires definitely a multidisciplinary team. And I'm not only talking about the vascular specialties who come at the end to do the treatment, like the vascular surgeon or the intervention radiologist. We need the gynecologists to be in the game. We need the urologists. We need the gastroenterologists. We need psychologists. And we need pain also physicians. So all these should come together in the management of the patient with pelvic venous disease. But eventually, the invasive treatment is in the hands of a vascular surgeon or the skilled intervention radiologist.
And probably, in a way, a lead of how we move from there and gathering the information as well. We have been over the clinical presentation, diagnosis, indications of the invasive treatment, technical details of the procedures itself, results, and follow-up. Is probably our natural question is the follow-up. How do you follow up those patients?
Well, I will get them back at 1 month. I will get them back at 3, 6 months, and then annually thereafter.
You perform ultrasound?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we'll discuss about their symptoms. Have they improved? We're gonna do a physical exam to see if we have any recurrent varices at the perineal area, and eventually an ultrasound. But if at 1 year they have no symptoms, I would probably stop following up.
Exactly, and those, as we talked, are young people who probably can reach out eventually if they have some problems. And then I would add a small follow-up question. Recurrence, usually, in your experience, does that appear within this first year?
Typically, yes.
Okay, so that's also
typically, yes.
a reasoning for the one-year follow-up, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Great. We are naturally going towards the end of our podcast, and I was wondering if you have any final remarks.
Well, as thoroughly discussed in the introduction, pelvic pain in women is more common than what we think. Women get lost in the medical system, so it's really, really imperative to keep discussing about, keep raising awareness. not only amongst physicians, but also to the public, because it really affects the quality of life, predominantly of women. And thank you again for bringing this up in today's podcast.
Thank you so much for sharing this with me and with the rest of the listeners. I certainly have learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have too. I wish you a great annual meeting. To our listeners, we once more send our regards from Krakow. More podcasts recorded here live coming up. Bye for now.